Hey there, this is Bram Kanstein, and you're listening to Bitcoin for Millennials. Together with my guests on this podcast, I go on a journey to discover how our current financial system works, why it's flawed, and why Bitcoin is the most relevant technology that you should understand and adopt. Today, I'm joined by Peter Dunworth. He's a financial advisor for high net worth individuals and families, specifically focused on Bitcoin with his company, The Bitcoin Advisor, serving clients since 2016. And he is also one of the people who I think has the highest price prediction of Bitcoin in the entire world. But the scary part is that his reasoning for it makes a lot of sense. Let's get into it. Welcome, Peter.
Pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I've really enjoyed your content, and you taught me a lot already. I think I'm a big novice in like the financial and economic dimensions of Bitcoin, and you're one of the people who has definitely helped me to understand more about it. But I wanted to have you on to obviously learn a bit more and hear your thoughts on what is happening with Bitcoin in the world and how it's changing. But I wanted to do a quick check in the beginning. Which generation do you belong to?
Good question. I'm not sure about that.
Which year are you born?
77, late 70s. So does that put me in the gen? No, maybe not Gen X.
I think you're Gen X then, yeah.
Okay. Let's see. Yeah. That's kind of the age group that lost out on the property, the huge property boom, the huge upswing in a lot of things, and mm-hmm. It was too old for the tech boom. However, we're in the perfect position for Bitcoin. So I think, swings and roundabouts, every generation gets an opportunity. And, you know, I think the baby boomers had an opportunity that was like no other in mm-hmm. investing in property and shares. And they had 40-year tailwinds that seem to be unraveling a little bit now. But for the best part, they had a 40-year relatively uninterrupted ascension to incredible capital values that I don't think they could have dreamed of back in the 80s. And we're in a very different position. You know, it's September 2023 and the tables have turned, so to speak. So it's a completely different investing environment to where we were in the early 80s.
Yeah. And so what got you into investing and finance in the beginning?
Good question. Probably just an interest in business. So having a father who was running a small business or small to medium-sized business, we talked about business as, you know, one of the things that we love discussing from, you know, probably age of 8 to 10 upwards. It was a dinner conversation. It was, you know, when we'd sit around or have a spa or swim in the pool or, you know, catch up, we'd be talking a lot about that because that was a huge focus for my father, and he was a huge inspiration for that interest in business and wanting to understand, you know, what it takes to make money and deliver services that people want to have. And that's what piqued the curiosity in that. But ironically, it took until Bitcoin to really understand what is money.
No, that's interesting. I have a question about money later, but mm-hmm. So you were interested in that. You grew up in an environment where you talked about that a lot. Mm. How did you turn that into your career or your interest, you know, especially in the advising side of things?
That was relatively easy because studying business at school, business and legal studies, that gave me a sort of a grounding or an understanding of what to be expected in the business world. And then the broadest degree that I think we could do from a business perspective is an accounting degree. So I studied accounting and finance, which gave me the most options to look at the broadest range of businesses that I could possibly serve. So every business needs an accountant. Yeah. And that gives you a really great understanding for the numbers, both sides of the balance sheet, P&Ls, balance sheets. It's really critical to understanding what makes a good business. And ironically, though, all of the studies never taught me about what is money. So therein lies a conundrum that, you know, you sit there and study accounting, study finance, and it's all about the, you know, the accounting for money, but no one actually tells you what it is. So mm-hmm. it's so curious.
Let's get to that then. How do governments control or influence money? But also, yeah, what is then your question to what is money?
How do they influence money? Well, they effectively have full control over it. So, you know, by law, they mandate What is legal tender? Legal tender is the money that you can use in the jurisdiction that you live in. So, where you are in Europe has a very different money to what we use in Australia. And the local governments who issue that money, well, firstly, they're responsible for issuing that money and controlling it. They are responsible for the issuance of the money. They're responsible for the destruction of that money. They're responsible for everything in and around that money, including the interest rates that are ascribed to the borrowing of that money. Ironically, it's typically set up as a quasi-government institution in the form of a Federal Reserve or a state-owned bank that dictates and mandates that the cost of money, being the interest rates that are required to pay for that money. So, in
And
effect,
when you
they've got.
say cost of money, is that then also kind of like the worth of the money, right? So when you say that they set the interest rates, I want to explain to people, like when they set the interest rates, right? They actually say what a bank has to, well, they borrow that money, right? The banks can get money, like that's like the lowest level of interest that they can ask for a loan, right?
Correct. And so typically a state-owned bank issues has interest rates at the lowest
Point.
available because that's considered the risk-free rate in the country that you're in. So in the US, it's the Federal Reserve. Their risk-free rate or the Federal Reserve overnight funds rate is it's sitting at about 5.15%, give or take. In Australia, it's 4.1. In Europe, I think it's a lot lower than that. And so that's considered the risk-free rate if you borrow from the government because that's perceived as being risk-free because they're the ones printing the actual supply into existence, which brings to the next dimension of money. So you've got the cost of money and then you've got the actual supply of money. So how much money is there? Is there less money than there was a year ago or is there more money? And this is probably what is on everyone's mind at the moment. In the last 12, well, 36 months, we've really seen a huge spike globally in the amount of money in supply. And what that does is that makes it very difficult to have price stability for services, goods and services. So a function of having an increasing supply in money is the fact that in order to preserve purchasing power of that money, the prices of everything need to go up. And hence the reason why in the last sort of 2 years, we've seen a massive increase in the inflation rate. And then, as a subsequent consequence of that, you've seen the cost of money and the interest rates that the Reserve Bank charges. The cost of money has basically gone up in an attempt to curb that inflation rate of rising prices.
But and in eventually it becomes kind of like a loop, right?
Yes.
Where the cost of the money goes up, prices, the numbers on whatever you want to buy goes up, therefore you need more money, and it's like an endless spiral. Does that in any way still reflect the value of the things that people want to buy, or like how can people judge that then?
It's very difficult because it distorts what the value of things are. When you've got a money supply that is expanding and contracting without any consciousness, the consumers and the residents have no consciousness around what's actually happening with the money supply because you don't get to see what's happening in real time. You only see the price of goods and services that you're purchasing on a day-to-day basis start going up exponentially, and you're wondering, when did it cost me $50 to go down to the local supermarket to pick up a few items? And it's like, well, this never used to be the case. The same basket of goods that, I picked up 3 years ago was costing half as much as it does today. It used to only cost me $25, but now it's at 50. And, when that starts happening across the board, all of a sudden people start going to their employer and saying, basically my cost of living's just doubled. I want a pay rise. A 2% pay rise is no longer on the cards. I need, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10%. And this is where we get to what you alluded to earlier, a wage price spiral where basically there's going to be inflation and the high inflation causes wages to go up and then wages going up causes prices to go up. And that's a bad place to be.
And then people are mostly talking about the number, right? Like I need more units to buy the same thing of value because a banana is still a banana and a house is still a house, right? And a phone is still a phone. Is this the biggest thing that people need to understand about how the financial system works? Or is there another thing that you think they don't understand and is even more important?
I think it's critical understanding how the money works. And ironically, no one really teaches you how the money works, probably for good reason. You know, I think Henry Ford said if people understood how the money worked, banks would be non-existent the next day, because people would be rioting and they'd be understandably upset about the fact that an arbitrary group of people get to set the supply of, you know, the amount of money that's in the system, and they get to control that at their whim, and they also get to set the cost of that capital. And this is where having a subjective oversight on these two control mechanisms, which have huge ramifications for the entire economy, the entire country, it affects the country at every level. It's a little bit disconcerting to think that, you know, a very small group of people have such an influence on the economic and broader prosperity of a nation.
Yeah. And if we unpack that a little, like, people go to work or they have a business, they earn, well, they spend their energy, right, to deliver a service or create a product and then sell it. Therefore, they get energy back in the form of what we call money, right? The coins and, or well, the numbers on the screen nowadays. But because so that is within your control, obviously, right? How much energy you put in, like how good of a quality your product or service is, and therefore like the amount of units you can ask for it. But then there's also this outside reality of, as you mentioned, a few people or an unknown entity of which most people don't know the names, the faces, etc. Like, they kind of create this, well, playing field in which you then have to play in order to keep the energy that you accumulated, right?
Correct. And this is the really tough thing, because once you understand that game, then the real game is afoot of how do you preserve that purchasing power?
Yes.
So you've got to understand that the purchasing power is being whittled away from you, or you're being robbed of that in some way, shape or form, typically in the form of inflation, because it's the most insipid form of it. However, once you understand that that is the game and your job is to preserve your purchasing power, your life force in a monetary form, then that sets you down the rabbit hole of what are the investing options to preserve that. So if you look across the broad spectrum of it, you need to then understand or become a master of, you know, investing in stocks, bonds, property, commodities, and, you know, my all-time favorite, Bitcoin. But that in itself is literally a full-time job, and you know, is one of our largest industries, is financial services. And why does that even exist? Because people have huge trouble actually deciphering what is the best investment for them and how do they go about, you know, understanding this. And it literally is a full-time job for me to, you know, effectively try and figure out what's happening in the market and understand what are going to be the best investment options for my clients moving forward. And this is something I do all day, every day, let alone, you know, I find it really
difficult doing
that full time. Correct. And here's the funny thing. Like, I do this all day, every day. And, you know, I struggle with this, particularly at this point in time. It's a very difficult time for investing and making clear long-term investment decisions. I can only imagine how tough it is for someone who has to do a 9-to-5 and then come home and try and figure this stuff out. Like, it is, it's a horrible position to be.
Being aware of it.
Yeah.
And being aware of the fact that you need to do that, right? We'll get to this in a minute, but I wanted to go back to the word. You used the word robbed, like you're getting robbed. In my conversations, I use this word too. But I find it that people find that a really difficult word. When you say you're being robbed by the government or you're being robbed by the people in charge or whatever, right? Like that, I find it very hard also to phrase it in a different way. But now that you use this word, like how can you explain this? Because sometimes I also see people, you know, share things about, you know, this 2% inflation is so low that you are slowly getting robbed. You don't really, you know, understand that you're losing the energy that you accumulated, you know, your wealth, your money. And if someone comes into your house and just steals 2% of your things, you don't really kind of notice it. But now that it's more, right? 5, 6, 7, 10 in some cases, well, hundreds of percentages in some countries. Why do you use the word robbed? And is that the most friendly word you can use, or?
No, but it's not the friendliest word to use, and it probably has connotations of being held up or armed robbery, is probably the initial connotation that or thought that is provoked by the term robbed. I think it's the most apt term for describing that, though, because the thing is that we don't have a choice in it. No one voluntarily says, I'll give 2% of my income because, hey, I'm a good person, or I'm happy to pay 2% to this inflation that's robbing all of us. It's an unfair and unasked for cost of being a resident in a nation. And so for that reason, I think it's the fairest term to say no one actually voluntarily asked to give that 2% away. And the only reason it's 2% is because the federal banks, you know, Federal Reserve or Reserve Bank of Australia or the ECB are basically carving out and creating these inflation rates that are effectively robbing us all of this. And, you know, the old analogy with, you know, a frog in a boiling pot of water, you know, when the water's just warm, the frog can stay in there all day and it's okay. But, you know, the second you turn that heat up and actually want to start cooking the frog, he's going to jump out of it. So the best way to do it is to, you know, lull them into a false sense of security, not too high, not too low, just right, so that the frog basically gets cooked and doesn't jump out of the pot. And this is why the inflation target is 2% and not 10%, because if it was 10%, you'd be bleeding out and your money would be halving every 7 years. And that is an unacceptable level of loss before the crowds turn around and basically start baying for blood. You know, no one wants to have their purchasing power halved every 7 years, because it means you effectively need to get a 7% pay rise every year just to stay even. So
yeah, and so that 2%, you know, this is also something that recently has been new to me. Like, is this kind of like following a certain economic ideology with in terms of growth, or is this a malicious thing? Like, how should you judge? How should you judge that? Why isn't it zero, for example? Like, what is the point here?
There's many layers to this question. Firstly, you know, there is a target rate of 2%. And to your question, why isn't it zero? That's a very good question. Why isn't it zero? Well, the powers that be, and Jerome Powell was in Congress recently or up on the Hill discussing that very question. Why is the number 2%?
And that because was others do. He said others do it or something. That was the explanation.
And that was deemed the acceptable level of inflation for price stability. But it's really not an acceptable level, particularly if you have the ability to have negative or deflation, where prices actually go down. And their concern is when you, and this is probably getting a little deep, but when you have an expansionary monetary system built on credit,
yes,
it's critical that you have inflation.
Which means, to illustrate, I'm also discovering for this podcast, right? Like, okay, how deep to go. But no, I love the direction where you're going, but I want to illustrate. So the debt-based system, you mean when someone deposits $100 in the bank, for example, mm-hmm. a bank can loan out 90% of that, which on paper is new money, right?
Yes.
For example, so I deposit $100. $10 is kept in the bank as my solid money or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The bank can loan it to you 90%. So $90, for example, to you, you can buy something for $90. And a person who gets that $90 can put that in the bank. And then $9 gets held and $81 gets loaned out again, right? Like, that's the debt-based system. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is where, if you don't have inflation, it's very difficult. That debt then gets very costly to repay, because part of the debasement of the money is the inflation, which means the debt is easier to repay. So there are some huge connotations to this. And a little side note on that fractional reserve lending, which you just highlighted. After the global financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, there was a financial accord struck, the Basel III Accords, which said how much money a bank needs to hold in order to lend out.
Yep. And of the deposited money, right?
Correct. So on a home loan across those banks that subscribe to it. And it was across the globe, like pretty much most major countries subscribe to it: China, the US, Europe, Australia, if you consider us a big country. But on a serious note, they all subscribe to it. And the capital adequacy ratio, which is how much you needed to have on deposit to lend, was 5%. So in order to lend $1 million, you needed to have $50,000 on hand. So 20x. And just a little side note, we're going through, and I'm not sure if you've discussed with your listeners, the choke point 2.0, where the banks are clamping down on crypto exchanges and transferring money from the banking system to them.
No.
But think about this from a deflationary perspective. If you've got $50,000 sitting in your bank where you are or where I am, and we move that $50,000 from the bank to the crypto exchange to buy Bitcoin and then self-custody it, you have effectively robbed that bank of the ability to loan out
A
$1 million.
million, yeah. Makes a
Now,
lot of sense. Yes. Oh my
well,
God. Yeah.
this is why the banks don't want to do it, because on that $1 million, they're probably making a 2% margin on it,
Yes.
$20,000. And so
If
all of a
not more,
sudden,
right? If it's a home loan or, over 30 years, 20, 30 years.
correct, that's per year, $20,000.
Oh, yes.
So, I mean, this is why they're not keen on having money leave to go to buy Bitcoin, because it's hugely deflationary for the entire market from a
Yeah.
credit perspective.
And so basically, this is where my mind goes. When you put your money in the bank, you're effectively lending it to the bank so the bank can lend it out 10 times over and earn money, of which you don't see any upside, right? When it goes right, when it goes wrong, then you will definitely see, you will be the one who pays the bill at the end. Correct? If a bank fails and it gets bailed out by a government or like that, all eventually comes from the taxes and the people or the money printing, and then it goes back to the debasement again.
Yeah, heads you lose, tails you lose. It's just
Exactly.
a
But also, when you say like they need 5%, they need to hold 5% of actual money, or at least something they can give to their customers of all the money that's been loaned out, right? So does that also mean that only 5% of people can actually get all their money out of a bank? If they go to the bank and say, I want my money?
Well, technically, it's worse than that, because the reserves they hold on bank are actually a whole lot less than the 5%. So, if you look at the US banking system, it's fractions of that. It's probably less than 1%. So, no, they don't have the cash available to give you if everyone went to the bank and said, "Hey, we want our money back." It's just not there. Sorry.
So if I sell you something and you give me cash and I hold it on me, I actually own it more than when I put it in a safe bank.
Correct, because if you stripped away all of the obligations that the bank had, they don't have the cash there. That's a critical thing to understand. Now, it might be backed by the government. In Australia, we've got the Four Pillars Policy, the Four Pillars Act, I should say. The Four Pillars Act basically is the four major banks in our country are guaranteed or underwritten by our federal government, so that if any depositor loses, deposits, they will cover that up to $250,000. But what happens if you've got $1 million sitting in one bank,
It's gone.
and that bank falls over? You've lost 750,000, but don't worry, the government will give you a check for 250, so you haven't lost all of it. So
All right. I think this is a nice stepping stone. We're slowly getting towards why why Bitcoin. I still wanted to ask you, when we talk about this, like, do you still think capitalism is the most ethical economic system, or isn't that even the topic that we are talking about? Like.
we don't know what capitalism is. Like we think we're operating with a capitalistic market. There is a pretense of a capitalistic market, but it is not a capitalistic market at all. It has all of the the trimmings of capitalism, or it's described that way. But the second you get the government involved and start regulating things, then that is no longer capitalism. That is crony capitalism, which is the government looking after the major stakeholders in an industry. And that's fundamentally what we have. We have market distortions created by government regulations to look after the large players in each of those industries. And Facebook, when they were under huge pressure and asked to go to Congress to basically discuss what they were doing to talk about online misinformation and the rest of it, because Donald Trump won the election, basically Mark Zuckerberg went to the regulators and basically said, we're going to pay for 18,000 moderators to sit on and basically review content on our site 24/7. And basically that was rubber stamped, and great, if anyone runs a social media platform, they need to have 18,000 moderators on the site to monitor, speech that's not satisfactory. Now, what startup on earth has the ability to pay 18,000 moderators to moderate content on a social media site? No one. So all of a sudden, that protection, that is basically a protection racket run by the US government to protect Facebook from any competition. Because if anyone wants to enter the social media scene to compete with them, where's your 18,000 moderators to make sure that no one's getting upset with, everything that's on here? And I'm like,
and that's the same for banks being compliant to a Basel or any other regulation, right?
Correct. And this is why the banks typically have the lowest interest rates, because they're the most closely aligned to the federal banks that operate in the jurisdictions. And then as you go out the risk curve, the interest rates of those, the lesser known banks goes up, because their cost of funding goes up as well.
Yeah. All right. So we talked about money, we talked about banks, we talked about holding wealth in, what are ways to hold wealth or invest in things to keep your wealth. What is wealth, and why should millennials care about it?
Ah, that's an interesting question. So what is wealth? Wealth, I believe, is fundamentally where you store your assets. And basically, wealth, I believe, gives clients options. It gives clients a sense of peace of mind, a sense of security, a sense of being able to know that if something were to happen to them, they have the ability to resolve certain situations that come up in their life. It might be a significant event in their life, like a parent might get ill or a child might get ill. You have to pay for that. I think wealth, in my understanding, basically provides options to people. So some people define it differently, but to me, I think it gives people optionality, and the more wealth you have, the more options you have.
And does that also tie into people wanting to be able to save that over time, that basically, right? That when you search for and hopefully find a vehicle to save that wealth, right? Because you don't know when you're going to get sick, or your child is going to get sick, or someone dies, or whatever. Is that also something you then take into consideration, like that time aspect?
I think it is, because our money is doing such a bad job of being a store of value. So because our money is so bad, we now have to look at, investing it in things like real estate or stocks to avoid that purchasing power just whittling away. And this is forcing people to think about, savings in a very different way. We now have people saving money in the form of buying investment properties or buying stocks or, God help them, bonds, as a way of, preserving wealth. However, that's typically, the conflation of a long-term and a short-term store of value. Store of value is meant to be a store of value where your money can actually store the value. But because the money is so broken, that money doesn't serve that function anymore. So we are forced out the risk curve to find riskier investments that serve that function of saving.
Yeah. Okay. And then we get to what is probably the core question I want to answer with this podcast, and I'm interested to hear your answer. What is Bitcoin and why should I care?
Here's Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin is whatever you want it to be. And I say that because it provides you the greatest optionality that I know of. And what do I mean by that? Bitcoin as, what is Bitcoin? Bitcoin gives you the optionality on purchasing anything you want with it. So what is money? Again, money is fundamentally whatever you want it to be, because everyone wants money. It can purchase anything. So effectively, Bitcoin is money and money is Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is basically whatever you want it to be. It's something you're going to hold as an option on trading for something that you want in the future. And what's really special about Bitcoin, I think, is that it has the ability to hold purchasing power over very lengthy periods of time without getting caught down or bogged down in all of those investment decisions that you would have to make around what's the best stock, what's the best property, how much debt am I going to take on with this property, what areas do I need to be in. It's a very simple savings tool that is going to preserve your purchasing power over the long term. And this is where, you know, as facetious as this sounds, what is Bitcoin? It's literally whatever you want it to be. It can be a savings tool. It can be used to purchase a house, a car. It can be used to do whatever you want, or alternatively, it can literally sit there like a pet rock to preserve your purchasing power into the future. And Ironically, that is my preferred way of thinking of Bitcoin, as, you know, my little pet rock that preserves purchasing power for the options that I may want to use in the future.
Yeah, it's funny. I actually have the same. Like, I'm a pretty risk-averse person and a control freak to some point. Like, I once made a tweet about that. Like, that's exactly why I'm into Bitcoin, because it's hard to understand. You know, obviously, that's why I'm talking on this podcast with people. But it's actually very simple. Like, I just see it as, how you said it, you know, that's the term store of value. I see it as a box where I put my wealth in, and I close the box and I don't do anything, and it just stays there. I don't have to look at anything. I don't have to calculate anything. I don't have to do anything. It sits there protected over time until I want to use it for something. But do you think that store of value element is where all the other stuff kind of like derives from, right? Like, if I want to pay for something, with Bitcoin, that other person is accepting it because they know they can store, you know, the energy that trade represents, right? Like the value of that car or whatever we trade, that they can also actually keep it in Bitcoin. So that's why they prefer it over any type of other money, because it does have the store of value element that the regular money, let's call it regular money, does not have, because it's melting at least 2% a year.
I think all of those points are valid. And in order to be a form of money, it needs to have some subjective value. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, people who are accepting Bitcoin, whether they accept it to convert it into, you know, fiat, or alternatively they accept it to add to their stack, I think are, you know, very closely aligned. But the person who's adding to their stack, I think, is a more meaningful Bitcoiner, because they're taking Bitcoin supply off the market and not adding sell pressure. So this is where a circular economy running with a store of value is going to create, there isn't enough circulating supply of Bitcoin to facilitate all of the trade that's required on a daily basis. And then this is where we see real price discovery, where the price of Bitcoin is going to go through the roof, because in my work...
Yeah, there's a limited amount of Bitcoin units to service an expanding amount of trade, right?
Correct. And this is the glorious thing about a hard cap limited supply asset like Bitcoin. They can't make any more of it. It's 21 million. That's it. And when people figure out what this thing is and they understand what is money, they're going to accept nothing but Bitcoin. And this is where, you know, there are a few companies we work with where they've gone down the rabbit hole. They work in and around Bitcoin. They have a very deep understanding of what it is. And ironically, they do nothing but accept Bitcoin for their services. Why? Because they understand what money is, and they don't want basically shitty fiat. And I mean, if you're in the ECB and someone came to you and said, hey, accept this Venezuelan Bolivar, it's as good as money. Yep. You know, you're going to tell them to beat it.
Because it has the label money, right?
Correct. But to you, it means nothing, because you don't care about the Venezuelan Bolivar, because It's probably halved in value just on the flight over from Venezuela.
Okay, so obviously you see Bitcoin now, but in the beginning you mentioned, you were interested in business, finance, economics, and it took you until learning about Bitcoin what actual money is. So what made you see Bitcoin? When did you realize what you were investigating or looking at?
It was a very slow process, sadly. It took me a very long time to understand it. And sadly, there weren't the resources that we have today, such as your podcast. Back when I was trying to understand it, there was a very limited understanding of it. There were very few books on it. And I was just very fortunate to have a brother who was very receptive to his older brother asking questions, and he was exceptionally patient. So it took me a very long time to get it. And I just wonder if I would take as long to get it if I started today. And sadly, I probably wouldn't, because there are so many things with Bitcoin that basically put you off the track. And I think about the first financial lesson that I was given as a child, was something along the lines of, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And when you talk about Bitcoin,
Yes.
it sounds too good to be true. Can you imagine
Yeah,
a
but
limited
later you
supply
realize
asset?
because everything else is so shitty. Right.
Yep. You do the work and you realize, well, look, I think this thing's too good to be true, and it probably is. So maybe I should allocate just a little bit of, my net assets to it. And then once I understand it a little bit deeper, then I can allocate more. But that is therein lies the dichotomy of Bitcoin, is that, you don't understand it, so you don't want to put money into it. But in order to understand it and learn faster, you need to put money into it. So there
Yes.
needs to be a fine line between, what are you prepared to lose if you're going to invest in this? And then how do you accelerate your learning? And, I think for anyone's skin in the game, accelerates learning. So it's about getting comfortable with what you're prepared to lose. If you and I are completely wrong about this asset and it does go to zero, what can you sleep at night with having put into Bitcoin? So
Yeah.
therein lies the conundrum for people to face, that you want to get started, but you don't want to be scammed. People don't want to look stupid. And
Yeah.
when you hear people saying, "Hey, this thing's amazing and it sounds too good to be true," our little
Yeah, it's
brains revert
daunting.
to.
It's daunting. Yeah. I do think like you have to be stupid in order to learn, right? Like you have to fail in order to figure out like what actually works. It's a really interesting paradox there. And just also as a little side note, like if Bitcoin turns out to be nothing, I think the thesis still stands, it's either nothing or it's everything, right? Like that's at one point I just adopted that. But I think I also once said in a podcast, like if this turns out to be nothing, like an actual scam or something, like if that actually turns out to be the thing, I really have some soul searching to do. Like after, looking into this for 10 years, thousands of hours, like this is just the logical thing that I end up with. And if this turns out to be not that thing, then I honestly I don't know what to trust anymore, right? Like I really feel like I scoured the grounds and I learned all the things. I always share like I bought my first Bitcoin at 300, but I also like that's not to flex because I also sold at 4,000, right? So everyone gets in at new at the next level
Congratulations.
of understanding. Well, yeah, congratulations. But when you see what it could have been, then you think like, oh, I was stupid. But at that moment, that was my decision, right? And then you get back at each new point of, I'd say, new level of understanding, not only the system that we talked about, but Bitcoin, but also yourself and, how, for example, how risk averse you are or not. And yeah, what you want to do to build your life, basically. What do you think is the main thing that people need to unlearn before they can understand Bitcoin?
Risk-free rate does not determine the value of an asset.
Which translates to
So our entire financial modeling, whether it's valuing stocks or valuing investments or understanding and, valuing risk or options, pretty much revolves around an internal rate of return. Like, And that is predicated on what is the interest rate that that asset is going to cost you to hold it. So the risk-free rate is typically the Reserve Bank of Australia, the Federal Reserve Bank of America. Whatever their interest rate overnight is typically seen, or the 10-year is typically seen as the risk-free rate of capital. So what that is that's a benchmark that your investment needs to return over just to break even, because you can give it
So that's
to
your
you can
risk, right?
correct.
That's
You can give it to the local bank risk-free, and they'll give it back to you because they print the money. Now, that's the minimum hurdle that needs to be made. And then you look at the cost of capital. What are the hurdle rates that you want to see in order on to get a return on something? And so the problem is that a lot of those returns and risks are basically calculated on the fact of what is the cash flow generated from holding a certain asset. So if you look at stocks, they have dividends. That's a return on the asset. You look at property, that's got rental yields. That's a return on property. If you look at bonds, they've got interest rates or coupons that they pay you. That's a return on holding an asset. So all of these different assets have a return profile, which determines how much you get paid for holding it. Enter Bitcoin and you get paid zero for holding it. So it's very difficult using the traditional financial metrics of valuing things to determine and ascribe a value for Bitcoin, because it breaks the mold in so many respects with Bitcoin and traditional assets. And I think about one of the things that sort of is diametrically opposed to traditional financial wisdom. Firstly, the first thing we've already discussed is if it's too good to be true, it probably is. Ironically, with Bitcoin, I don't believe that is the case. It's better than we understand it to be. We just don't have a clue of how good this thing can be. You look at Bitcoin and you think, well, there's no interest rate with Bitcoin, so there's no return on it. So how do we value something that doesn't have a return on it? Whereas all other assets on Earth, bar the commodities, have a return on it. So, you're sort of trying to mesh two worlds, and there's no real way of doing that. And then the other thing is, Bitcoin is a transformational asset that, basically transcends any of the traditional forms of assets that we're familiar with today, and will totally redefine what assets are and what the function of money is. But we just don't know that today, because this is basically a monetary instrument that's wrapped up in a new technology that we really, we can talk about understanding it, but we have no understanding of what the implications are going to be with this long term in society. And this is where we do our best to understand it. And, I try and apply a finance lens around it to come up with some form of valuation metric for valuing this thing, but it's very difficult because you need to suspend belief in the traditional ways that, you've been trained to value things.
So when you say it transcends these other things, like what's like the core understanding in that? Like why do you say that? What is so different, basically?
There are probably, I think, four things that are different about it to anything that has ever existed before. And these are four key technologies which I think will totally redefine society. It'll reshape things. And we don't have a way of understanding what the implications of this will be just yet, or how to value it. So if I look at Bitcoin as a technology first and foremost, and the technologies that have been found or discovered with Bitcoin, however you want to describe that, and then ascribe those technology step function improvements to money itself, I think there are four key things that are a technology improvement that we have never seen before. Now, the first is seizure resistant. We've never had an asset that is seizure resistant. So this is an asset that you and I can walk around with 12 words in our head. That is a profound improvement of holding gold, or trying to store gold on your body, or hide it, or have a title for a land deed, or a land title, something like
So
that.
no
It
one can take that from you, right?
that's it. That's
That's
it.
a point.
Huge thing.
And with all other assets, that basically is not the case, right? As you may, like if you hold a bar of gold, I shoot you, I get the gold, it's mine, right? But even with real estate, for example, like I think well, I know some millennials, who are into real estate. Even that, as you mentioned, it's a deed, right? Like it's a piece of paper, and when you sell your house to me, the name changes, right? From your name to mine. But that's still, that ownership is, well, probably with a lot of rules, right? It's kind of shown as to be mine, but still everything that determines whether or not it's mine is outside of me. Right?
Correct. And it is yours at the discretion of your government.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as you play by their rules, that's yours. However, the second you step out of line, it is no longer yours. And you just need to look at, you know, the foreign reserves of Russia and what happened in the last 18 months to 2 years, that they thought they owned those assets. Turns out they're on the SWIFT system and their $500 billion in foreign reserves are no longer controlled by them.
Yeah.
They're not
theirs. I think this for... Well, especially millennials in the Western world, sounds very dark and unfamiliar.
Yeah.
You know, say, like I attest, like I agree with it, but it also feels very foreign to me, right? Like a government could take away your house or your business or whatever. But perhaps it's not about the actual, you know, action, but more about the concept, as in you only own it by... because other people allow you to own it, right? Maybe if we stick to that concept, right? And then we say like, well, because it is that, the people that allow you to own it can also take it away from you conceptually, right? And that should trigger something, well, as to how much you, how do you say, accept that, right? If you accept that,
of course,
then it's fine.
Yeah. Well, this is the problem that, you know, in Western democracies, we haven't really had cause to question our governments and their ability to take our things. I think, tell me if I'm wrong or not, but I think you had a little bit of trouble with some farmers over there where the government wanted to take their land. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they had no choice in whether they wanted to sell it or not. The government was going to take it.
Well, I'm not that familiar with it, but I think conceptually, yes, the answer is yes. But I don't know everything about it. I also do think it's bigger outside of our country than actually within our country. Or maybe that's the whole point that we know.
It could be, but regardless, it's outside of the control of the property owner to determine what they want to do with it.
Yeah, so that's the point.
That is absolutely the critical point, that we have never had to think about this until now.
Mm-hmm.
And now all of a sudden there seems to be some fairly egregious overreach on behalf of our governments to want to dictate what we do with our own property. And the whole question of property rights is now up for debate again.
Yeah. So do you actually own what you think you own?
And the question, well, the answer to that is very simply no. We don't. Mm-hmm. We no longer own what we think we own. We own that at the discretion of our government, that as long as we play by the rules and are seen to be good actors, then that is, you know, the government will allow us to continue to think we own it. But if for whatever reason they don't want you to do that or don't want you to hold that, they have the power to take that from you, which is terrifying.
Yeah. So does that also tie into, I wrote this down and I think you mentioned it now before, like I don't really view storing my wealth in Bitcoin as buying or investing. I just think of it as a safer place to put that what I accumulated. Like, what's your view on that?
It sounds like you're almost getting to think about Bitcoin as a unit of account, and the financial game that you're playing is very different to most people, in that most people are counting how many dollars they have. Mm-hmm. And your game that you're playing, by the sound of it, is how many Satoshis you have.
Well, that's interesting. I don't know if I am there yet, but I more view it as like, okay, I had, well, yeah, it's a fair point. Like I had money energy in one system, which, well, also in this conversation, I think my end conclusion was I don't think that is the best system. I found a better system, a supreme system. That's where I'm moving that energy to store it until whenever I want or need to use it. So that's where I'm at. I do understand what you're saying, and I see some people as well, like they only think about, okay, how many Satoshis or how many Bitcoin do I have? Like, I still think in euros and dollars, like, I have to buy bread and coffee.
Yep.
So I'm definitely not there yet. I meant it more in a way that when you understand that that system that you're basically forced up in because you were born in country XYZ, right? If that is something that you don't think is most beneficial for building your wealth, then you just move to something else.
Yeah. And I think this is a conclusion that a lot of Bitcoiners get to after studying this thing for countless hours, that, you know, when you compare that to the opportunity cost of investing in something else, it's very difficult to justify investing in other things other than Bitcoin, particularly at this point in time. Very difficult.
And is this why but also others say that that Bitcoin could be a solution to the problems that, you know, the current system creates?
Yeah, I think it could be. And this is where it will not be without a fight, though, because governments want to have control. And this is where we've seen central bank digital currency, CBDCs, rolled out. Or they want to roll that out. And why is that? Because they want to maintain control of the ledger. And, you know, I'm reminded of an old saying, he who controls the pen wins.
Mm-hmm.
If you get to write what's on the ledger, you've got a very high chance of winning whatever game you're playing.
Yes.
And the governments do not want to forfeit.
You basically make the rules, right? The ruler that makes the rules.
And, you know, not many people want to give up that pen once they've got it. And the government sure as hell don't want to do that, because then someone else is writing their ledger and they are then accountable to someone else.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a great illustration of what Bitcoin gives. Everyone has the pen.
That's the funny thing. And to me, it's the fairest game I've seen. And it's the other thing that I think it totally redefines in society is the ability to trust again. That we now have a ledger that is fair.
Because
that
you
everyone
don't
can
have
access.
To.
That no one can alter.
Yeah.
And the ability for no one to alter it means that it's fair for everyone.
Yes.
And this is something that, you know, in light of all that we've gone through and the economic sort of upheavals that we've seen since COVID, this is something that I think is longed for from broader society, that they don't understand what this thing is. They don't understand what a ledger is. And most importantly, they don't understand the importance of, you know, not being able to have a government to rewrite the ledger to suit them. So this actually works for the masses, but I think the government's going to do a very good job of creating a PSYOP that is going to tell everyone how horrible Bitcoin is, because it's going to, I don't know, boil the oceans or whatever other FUD you want to think of.
Yeah. And that's what I also really love about Bitcoin, that forced transparency, basically, you know, like the boiling the oceans argument, I think is very interesting, because Bitcoin is ultimately, you know, is fundamentally transparent, even with this energy use, you know, like the rebuttals of any simple argument against Bitcoin are so basic and so simple that for me, you know, it makes me laugh sometimes when I see these things where I think, like, you're trying to play, you know, the people who argument against Bitcoin, they're trying to play within this old game of obscurity and vaguely describing, you know, and any counter arguments and stuff like that. But because Bitcoin is fundamentally transparent, like there's a rebuttal to any counter argument based in the foundation of the actual thing. It's not even an opinion of people, you know, it's just a representation of the data in that sense. And I love that contradiction between, you know, if you have to say you're transparent or honest or whatever, you are not, right? You can only be that when you can show it. And I think Bitcoin can show that 24/7, 365, all around, where any alternative to that does not have that. And therefore, even just that simplest thing for me makes Bitcoin superior in that sense, right? Like, yeah.
And this is a very hard lesson to learn, because, you know, when you're entering a new area, you don't know a lot about it, and you see mainstream media, you know, describing narratives that are, you know, are trying to undermine Bitcoin. It's a very easy thing to, you know, to get behind and support. But, you know, the narratives of FUD are basically, I believe, about Bitcoin, you know, about the negative effects of it, is storytelling without facts. And then this is the glorious thing about Bitcoin, is that you get to present the counter arguments to that and absolutely wipe the floor with a whole host of really well thought out, well researched arguments that totally destroy the reasons why you wouldn't want this in the mainstream. So we're very fortunate. Like, there are a lot of super smart people working on Bitcoin, and every day I'm shocked at, you know, how clever some of the people are who've, you know, basically done a lot of work to counter a lot of these arguments against Bitcoin. So we're exceptionally fortunate in that capacity.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I love Daniel Batten on Twitter, who has a big investment fund in Bitcoin-related energy companies, right? And the companies that are mining. And I absolutely love how do you say, like, well, methodical and scientific he is in countering any any argument that comes, you know, any energy or environmental argument that comes across his table. Yeah, that's amazing. And I also actually really love, I don't know what the title is of the article your brother wrote.
Oh, Bitcoin is time traveling energy.
Yeah, that and anyone, I would say Google that, but also read it like five times before you actually understand a bit of it. It was, yeah, crazy. But I love, like, I think that's also kind of like why at least I'm into Bitcoin. Like, I learned so much. Learned so much, and I unlearned so many things that, yeah, I just really enjoy. I now enjoy being wrong or learning something new, you know, like my origin, like what I told this in the previous podcast, like when I worked at a bank, I learned that the money in the bank is not yours. And at that moment, I just thought, like, I'm such an idiot, like, I'm an idiot. But okay, now I really want to understand, you know. And I think that's just a fun way of operating, basically, just understanding that you don't know everything, and that, you know, other people's spend their time and energy to explain their point of view. And then if you do the time by reading something someone else wrote, you know, and do the reflection as to how much you actually understand or how it changes your beliefs, I think, you know, we can only turn out for the better there. So I wanted to finish up with three last questions. What kinds of first principles influence your thinking about the topics that Bitcoin touches? Like, obviously Bitcoin touches a lot of dimensions: politics, economics, finance, tech.
I think for me, the number one primary driver, sort of from a first principles perspective, which I think is exceptionally powerful in understanding the world and understanding any problem that you're trying to solve, is show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome. Understanding incentives in a system is critical for determining what is happening there. And this is where Bitcoin, I think, is the most perfect system for aligning incentives that I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
And understanding that incentives are aligned at every level in this system, it tells me that this has the highest probability of surviving and succeeding. And that is critical to understand from a first principles perspective. Now, that doesn't really help in understanding Bitcoin, but from a first principles perspective, I think it's very important to then understand what is Bitcoin and go down that rabbit hole of, you know, searching for understanding it on a deeper level, so that you can understand that this is the most perfect system that's ever been developed for aligning incentives for 8 billion humans.
Yeah.
This is a huge, it's a complete sea change that we've never seen before. Nothing on earth has had the opportunity to, you know, align 8 billion people's interests.
Yeah.
You know, the best we've been able to do, depending on how you look at it, is, you know, Facebook's got 2.8 billion people. You know, whether or not that's an alignment of interest, that's another thing. But, you know, that's, you know,
to some degree, probably, group of people.
Yeah, but that's a collective group of people. And, you know, maybe the largest religion on earth has been able to align 2 billion people's interests, but nothing has captured everyone. Mm-hmm. And this is where, you know, I look at Bitcoin from a first principles perspective. And once you understand, show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome. Understanding what is the primary driver of humans.
Yeah.
Sadly, we haven't developed past the reptilian brain. It's that simple. Under pressure, that reptilian brain and those instincts get amplified, and our most primary of decision making comes down to two things: fear and greed, fight or flight. And so once you understand that that's the thing driving our, sophisticated and cultured brain, we're really no better than little reptiles running around making decisions based on that. But we then have the abstraction to, create reasons for it. But at the end of the day, it comes down to greed and fear. And when people understand this, they're going to get really greedy to have more, and they're going to be really fearful if they don't have any.
Well, and if we tie that back to what we talked about, the money in the banks and they're only obligated by rules to keep 5% of the money. Well, if you talk about incentives, right? If you only need to keep 5%, then your incentive is to, well, spend or lend that other 95% to anything, basically. And what is the outcome of that is a foundationally flawed system, right? That eventually, when it keeps on growing, it has to blow up at some point.
That's it. And therein lies the opportunity for something that has a virtuous cycle. And this is where Bitcoin, I think, has that ability.
All right. Well, let's talk about your price target. If we don't measure in how many Bitcoins someone has, it's crazy to say, but it's in the million, in the billions of dollars per Bitcoin. What's the simplest way to explain how you got here?
There are two ways that we can get to a multi-billion dollar Bitcoin. There's a more nuanced take on it, which leads to a much higher number than what I'm about to go through. But the simplest way of looking at this, I think, is thinking about, if Bitcoin is the most perfect form of money that we've created, once people understand that, they will want for nothing else when it comes to dealing in trade. So,
So it's what we mentioned before, right? If I know that Bitcoin is superior and I am selling something, I only want Bitcoin
yeah,
for it.
give me the good stuff. I don't want the US dollar. I don't want the euro.
All right.
I want the real stuff. Give me the real money. And this is how countries around the world suffering from hyperinflation deal. They want and they pay a premium for the US dollars because that's not hyperinflating relative to the local currency. So understanding that premise that I think we're all driven by reason and we make rational decisions. Once people understand that this is the best form of money ever invented, people are going to only accept Bitcoin for payment of their services. There is 900 Bitcoins minted on a day, and we've got $6.3 trillion of global trade on a daily basis. So, assuming that there's a functioning credit market and stablecoin on Bitcoin that we can effectively use, then my expectation is that all global trade will be facilitated by what is mined on the day. So that would be 6.3 trillion divided by 900 Bitcoin. And that would give us a valuation close to $7 billion.
Yeah, it's wild.
Yeah.
So basically, you say if everyone wants the best form of money for whatever they trade, they will trade anything they have for the amount of that money that is available.
Correct. And, you think about this, and a lot of people go, oh, but that would be more money than is in the world right now. And, like, yes, that is correct. It would be because market cap is downstream of price, which is created at the margin. So,
Yes,
price is created at the
which means
margin.
what someone will pay for it, right?
Correct.
Not the
Yeah.
total accumulated amount of money. Do I
Correct.
say that correctly? Okay.
Correct. And this is where market cap is really a meaningless metric. So a lot of people hear that and go, oh, that's not possible because instead of, a quadrillion dollars worth of value in the world, there'd be thousands of quadrillion dollars worth of value in the world. It's like you're missing the point. But, understanding that people will only accept the best money and there's only a certain amount of Bitcoin minted on the day, that to me is the truest expression of what Bitcoin should be valued at because it provides the greatest optionality in the future. Now, we're a long way from having 8 billion people educated on that understanding, but this is the beauty of this podcast. We get to discuss these ideas, think about it rationally. If anyone thinks that, these ideas and thoughts are, nonsensical or outlandish. I'm happy to hear the rebuttal, but based on, some of the things that we've discussed tonight, that's my expectation of what will happen. Now, how long it takes to get there is another question. How long's a piece of string? I don't know. But understanding that at some point in time, the world will understand what the best form of money is. And unless you are very low IQ or maybe don't understand how the world works, there's only one form of money that you'll want to accept, and that is Bitcoin.
All right, and to extend on that before we wrap up, like if that represents more dollar units than what the actual money in the world is, right? Which is basically what people tell you. Isn't that also the point where we lose those numbers and it's more about the value of the asset in which we then s save and trade, basically? Wouldn't that eventually result in a lot of prosperity? That people will actually do more valuable work to earn this ultimate asset.
Yes, it will. It would, I believe it would totally redefine society, and it would allow us to, to quote Gigi, it would allow us to do value for value. So there'd be far less frivolous opportunities squandered, because you've got access to cheap credit. When credit's really expensive, you want to build something that's really valuable that people are going to want to pay a fortune for, because doing anything other than that is a huge opportunity cost to just holding your Bitcoin. So all of a sudden, I think humans are going to get ex insanely creative to create these opportunities of value to deliver to Bitcoiners throughout the world. And then all of a sudden, it's going to unlock a whole host of, human ingenuity and creativity that's going to produce a whole host of things that we can't even imagine today. So I think it completely redefines and reshapes what our future looks like for the better.
Sounds like that results in true capitalism
It may well, it may well. And I,
then.
not that I think that there's no place for the government, I think there is in some way, shape, or form, but I just think it will be in a drastically reduced position to what it is today.
All right. Last question. What's a core belief you will never let go?
To make light of this, I try and keep an open mind, so I'm not sure about a core belief that I have that I will never let go. And I'll share with you one story about
Okay.
why that what changed my thinking on this. So it's quite comical and to think about this, but I was an absolutely toilet paper over guy. And the argument, yeah,
Had
exactly. This sounds so
I
ridiculous.
had this argument day before yesterday. Okay, all
Okay.
right. Well,
So now, before we go into it, are you an over guy or are you an under guy?
I'm an over guy, but I heard a really compelling under argument.
Well, I've been an over guy my entire life. Until I got a dog that loved eating toilet paper. And so the over guys, when you've got a dog, they will just literally empty the roll and it goes. And it's like, oh my God, now the dog's eaten the whole toilet roll and got to deal with those issues. However,
Yeah, you can
an
hide it on the
under,
backside.
well, on an under, they just keep running and that thing keeps folding over and the dog never gets the tissue. So it never comes off the spool. So this is, an opinion I held really tightly was I was an over guy for many, many years, but the dog changed my mind about 6 years ago, so I try not to hold any opinions too tightly.
All right. Well, that's very funny. I think I had this conversation with my girlfriend. We are both over people, but she also really wants a dog. So maybe that'll change at that moment when we have a dog. Okay, that's a great answer. Well, thanks so much for this talk. I really enjoyed it. Where can people follow you, find you? This is the moment to share.
Thank you. Well, the website I've got is thebitcoinadvisor.com, and that is advisor with an ER. You can find me on Twitter, Peter BTC Advisor. And any questions, my DMs are open. Love to talk and help anyone who's looking at collaborative custody or estate planning, concerned about self-custody in that capacity. We do a really good job of making sure clients are in a position to hold and securely self-custody their own Bitcoin. And I'm proud to announce that in the last 7 years, we haven't lost a single Satoshi helping clients do this. So it's a record I'm very proud of. And I would like to see all coins come off the exchange so we can see some real price action, price discovery. So that's it for me.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, and keep in touch.
Bram, love to. Thanks, Mark.
Cheers.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, it would be amazing if you could rate, review, and subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. It will help us educate more millennials on the importance of Bitcoin. You can follow and connect with me on Twitter. I'm Bram K. That's at BRAMK. And if you are or know someone who has an interesting perspective on Bitcoin that's worth sharing, hit me up. I read and reply to every single message. I appreciate your support and hope you'll be here for the next episode. Thanks for listening. Bye.